This episode is brought to you by Intuit QuickBooks Bill Pay. You didn't start a business to spend your Sundays chasing invoices and manual data entry. But as you grow, accounts payable starts to feel like a full-time job you never applied for. Bills pile up, approvals get lost in email, and your vendors are constantly asking, "Where's my check?" It's distracting, it's stressful, and it's keeping you from the work that actually moves the needle. Intuit QuickBooks Bill Pay is the exit ramp. QuickBooks Bill Pay automates the busy work that eats your calendar by bringing every bill, every vendor, and every payment into one organized dashboard. Stop chasing details and start seeing the big picture. Know exactly what's due, who needs to sign off, and how it impacts your cash flow before the money leaves your bank. Vendors can even manage their own details so you stay in control of how and when you pay. Grow with confidence and put your AP on autopilot in QuickBooks. Learn more at QuickBooks.com/BillPay. Again, that's QuickBooks.com/BillPay. Terms apply. Money movement services are provided by Intuit Payments, Inc., licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by the lovely people at Cooker, spelt Cooker, pronounced Cooker. 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Today's another special.
Woohoo!
Today is a conversation with Robert Lacey, who's a renowned biographer and the historical consultant to The Crown, the TV show. He's written a book called, it's the second book actually, because he writes the book which goes along with the series. This one's called The Crown, Political Scandal, Personal Struggle, and the Years That Defined Elizabeth II. And these years are 1956 to 1977. You're going to thoroughly enjoy this podcast. Even if you don't like the royal family, you're going to love it because there's so many interesting
things. Even if you don't watch The Crown,
We live in a country with a royal family. Robert Lacey knows about the royal family. And for an hour, this is an insight into them and who they are and what sort of people they are. And I think it's fascinating. Robert Lacey is he's one of the best people I've ever had a conversation with. His knowledge is phenomenal. And his interest in the royals is something else. He seems to know absolutely everything about them. So, well, listen, let me get on with it. This is Robert Lacey.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Robert, thank you for joining me and my kitchen today. I buy all my guests a present. I bought you a nice bottle of red wine. I hope.
Thank you.
Do you drink?
Can I unwrap it?
Of course you can. Yeah,
I love it.
Do you drink, by the way?
I love a nice glass of red wine.
Oh, perfect. That's
and
good.
I see the shape of the bottle. It looks like a Burgundy. And sorry, a Bordeaux of some sort. A claret. Ombi Doc 2016 Chateau Senejac. That is wonderful.
Well, the man in the shop tells me it's a nice.
Oh, I thought you got it out of your cellar, Tim.
If only I had a cellar. So you're here to talk about your book. I think the best thing to do to start with is I've met you before, but can we get a bit of history and how you know about the royal family or how you know so much about the royal family?
I've been writing and studying the royal family since the 1960s, early 1970s. So I dread to think how many decades ago that is. And I was a young historian and journalist. I was working on the Sunday Times Colour magazine. I was also writing in my spare time books on the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. And I was drawn by the appeal of now living in the reign of Queen Elizabeth II and looking at how the world, how Britain in particular, England, had changed. So I was, and the different role of the monarchy lost its power, but increased its hold on people's imagination. And so my study of the monarchy has always been a matter of sociology almost, or psychology, putting us all on the psychoanalyst couch. And that turned out to be the same sort of thinking as Peter Morgan when he was doing his now famous movie, The Queen, with Helen Mirren, that won so many Oscars at the beginning of this century, about what happened after the death of Diana. And we hit it off. I particularly loved Peter's gift for invention. I'm sure we're going to talk about history together. But I'd just like to start by, you know, setting the tone by focusing on the imagination in The Crown, because that's what my book is about, as well as the history. There's a famous scene in The Queen when Elizabeth II is out on the moors on a deer hunt. And did you see it? Do you remember it?
I haven't seen that, no. I've watched The Crown, but I haven't seen that.
Because usually when I say this, people's eyes light up.
Right, okay.
And it's the moment they remember when the Queen, on this deer hunt, is confronted by the deer itself. She's got lost, and there is the deer standing on the riverbank in front of her. Superb monarch of the glen. And she suddenly realizes that they are both endangered species. She's being pursued by the press. He's being pursued by her friends, the hunters. And she starts talking to the deer. And she warns it. And she says, shoo, shoo, you must go away. And the deer runs away and is saved. Now, nobody imagines for a minute that the Queen has ever in her life talked to a Highland stag. But that moment captures the essence of the film. And The Crown is like that. It's a succession. I mean, the stag scene is now taught in film schools around the world as the essential piece of invention and fantasy that you need to mix with history to bring it to life as drama.
Do you like the Queen, and do you like the royal family? Because they're two different things, I think.
Well, particularly in these weeks of Prince Andrew, yeah. I think those are definitely two different things. And we're going to see over the months ahead how that plays out. Because after all, if all the royal family were like Prince Andrew, they'd be out of business. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if the royal family didn't contain the odd Prince Andrew, it wouldn't be an authentic family. If everybody's got someone like that in the family. So I think you've put your finger on one of the reasons why it matters to us. It is an emblematic family, and we look to it for lessons of to admire, and there, of course, we look to the Queen. But actually, the delinquents in the family, and we saw with Diana, the rebels in the family, they all have their role in... Americans, when I talk about this, sort of sniff, you know, how sad it is. They just regard the royal family as a branch of show business. And I say, but look, you know, in this country for the last half century and more, our whole system has been based on homage to a woman. And our head of state is a woman. And every powerful man in the country has to bow the head to this woman. And the same happens when powerful men come to this country. Our antique system has delivered that reality, which reflects in the modern world, and so far the great Republic of America hasn't managed to afford power to a woman.
What a brilliant way of looking at it. And I keep having this conversation with people. The Crown has really opened my eyes, bizarrely. I sort of just didn't ever think about the royal family. They were just there. And then after watching The Crown, I started analysing it. I've spoken to you about it. And, you know, I was kind of intrigued by what will happen, the future of the royal family. And one of the things that I think is having a woman, a motherly figure as well, at the head of the country is quite a nice thing. How does that change when she dies and Prince Charles arrives? Sorry, just go back one bit, though. You say about America. What I loved, I'm never sure whether I'm a royalist or not. And then when Donald Trump arrived in this country, I thought, thank God we've got the Queen to go and stand next to him rather than Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, who were around at the time. I was like, geez, those two, to me, are just a waste of space at the moment, all the politicians. At least we've got someone we can go, thank God we've got our Queen we can throw there in front of Donald Trump, because he's a big... And he was really...
He was cut down to size,
yeah,
wasn't he?
He was bowing down to her and everything. So it was that beautiful moment where our country felt great again, you know? But what happens when Charles steps onto the throne?
Well, there are big questions ahead. I think Prince Charles has recovered quite a lot of the popularity. Well, it doesn't matter about popularity. Let's talk about respect. That's the word. That's the concept you're playing with. I think he's recaptured a lot of the respect he lost for a time. And strangely, Camilla, who once seemed such a source of controversy, I think people quite look forward to the prospect of her beside Charles. I don't think she's going to be called Queen. I think the thought is she's going to be called Princess Consort. But I've had to reflect on that recently with the new season of The Crown, because in this new season of The Crown, we see Charles getting it off with Camilla. This is before Diana appears on the scene. We've got to wait a year for Diana. So by the accident of how the Crown is cut up historically, we are reminded that Camilla was had a place in Charles's heart long before Diana appeared.
Before we get to there, because we're just on it, I'm just quite intrigued by Charles, and I thought this would come later in the chat, but the bit about him being a man and the Queen being a woman is quite important in this day and age. It's different having a king, isn't it? And when a lot of people are sort of talking about the patriarchy, she doesn't represent that at all. She sort of represents, as I said, motherly figure.
Yeah, you talked about a mother figure.
It's really different when you stick a man and call him a king. Do you think we're ready for that at all?
We may not be. No, I think the monarchy has got rough waters ahead. It's always having to earn its living, earn its respect. One of the remarkable things about the reign of Elizabeth II is that Australia, in the course of her reign, has had two referendums about a monarchy, and twice the Queen has come through and survived.
She'd definitely win at the moment, wouldn't she?
She would, but when Australia decides, because, you know, Australia is one of these 14 or 15 interesting countries in the Commonwealth, which doesn't just acknowledge membership of the Commonwealth, actually has the Queen as their head of state, as Canada does, for example. I always think it's funny that across the north of the great Republic of America, you've got this old-fashioned monarchy. Maybe it's a new-fashioned monarchy, they would say. Whether Charles is going to command the same respect remains to be seen. But then, of course, after Charles will become William, and I think our spirits lift a bit more. No disrespect to Charles, but I think people feel that William and Kate are carving a good way ahead, and the monarchy will be safe in their hands. It's just a reminder of how important personality is to the success of the institution.
I really want to get on talking about the crown and stuff. I've got so many questions, but just on that, is there a chance that Prince Charles wouldn't take the crown and pass it straight on to William?
I think it's not impossible. Ooh. I think so. I mean, we know that personally he wants it, but one of the themes I'm sure we're going to be exploring with the Queen is how these royal figures have two sets of considerations always, their own personal ones, but their duty. I mean, I don't wish ill on him because, you know, and he's my sort of age too, but, say he began to feel as Harold Wilson feels in this season of The Crown. He was only 60 then. He dearly wanted to stay on in power till the Queen's Silver Jubilee in 77, which he'd helped plan. But he was starting to get memory loss.
Right.
And he was feeling, you know, he was showing the first signs of what became later diagnosed as Alzheimer's, dementia.
Yeah.
Well, in those circumstances, a king would feel it his duty to step down.
Yeah.
And we might get William earlier than we expect.
Does the Queen know you?
I think the Queen probably has me on that list of people she throws darts at, I think, who are popped up regularly to give opinions on the royal family. I've met her. I wouldn't say, no, she, I think, obviously, I know her. I don't think she knows me, no.
Do you enjoy writing, being consultant for The Crown?
I love it because it gives a new dimension to royal studies. I mean, in my career as a writer, historian, I've spent quite a lot of time in Saudi Arabia. I was drawn to that because it was an organic family monarchy. This is 30 years ago when it was a friendlier place and seemed to be moving in a more democratic direction than has since materialized. So power structures all over the world have interested me. I spent several years living in Florida investigating the mafia and their Jewish advisor, Meyer Lansky. So family structures and family power is an ongoing interest with me.
What I can't get from the you can get it a bit from The Crown, but Did she actually want to be queen? Does she like it?
Well, Tim, you've there asked a question that in all my years of studying her, I've never thought of. it's a very good question. I think she's so overwhelmed with her own sense of duty that question has probably never occurred to her. It is her duty. 1936, when she was only, 12, 13 years old, suddenly she was a junior princess who suddenly became heir to the then king. And we then, almost immediately, she's thrown into the war years between the ages of 13 and 18, those years when we all get shaped. She lived out at Windsor with the bombs falling and doing her duty and becoming a public figure. That's when the stiff upper lip, never complain, never explain, when that all started. And I think there's a sense in which she's been fighting the war ever since. Mm. I mean, it's part of her strength that, as we see in this, in this latest season of The Crown, going to Aberfan. She felt she was on duty, and she felt she couldn't do her. We're talking about the mining catastrophe in 64, I think it was 65.
Yeah, it's when what do they call those slag heaps?
Yes.
It fell down onto the school and killed all the school children.
That's right, over 100 children.
Yeah, and, horrific.
And members of the royal family like Lord Snowden and Prince Philip went rushing there. Mm. The Queen wouldn't go. As we were just discussing before we switched on the microphones, it's a bit like that situation after Diana died, when she stayed up in the Highlands of Scotland, mm. When she met the mythical stag. That's when we see that behind the dutiful facade of this figure is quite a beating heart. I mean, she didn't want to go to Aberfan because she thought she'd cry. In the early days, she said, look, if I go, I will distract attention from the rescuers. Quite true. After 7-8 days, that was no longer an issue. And frankly, just as after Diana's death, she just didn't know if her emotions wouldn't get the better of her. And I suppose it's rather sad that she considers her duty involves the suppression of emotions.
I watched that episode last night. I'm up to 3 now, and I made sure I watched that because it's the one that everyone's talking about on social media. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have watched it before interviewing you or speaking to you here, having a conversation with you. And I just found it really moving. And you could see in that period that the Queen is, I need to think differently. If I'm going to carry on, we need to think differently. Mm-hmm. That must be throughout the whole of her reign. She must have keep on evolving the royal family.
Yeah.
It's constant.
We now have this thing called the walkabout, which perhaps, younger people don't realise that the walkabout didn't exist in the 1950s and the early 60s. The Queen walking about with ordinary people. That was part of the problem at Aberfan time. She just didn't have the practice at going in among the crowds. Walkabout, obviously, an Australian term that was that was used. When it came to making the crown, we had to regard Aberfan in a very, very serious way. Mm. It was decided, whereas normally the crown likes to shoot in the very place where a particular incident happened. And we haven't shot in Buckingham Palace yet, but we've shot in places like Lancaster House and other official venues, which the royal family are happy to loan out for a consideration. But it was decided certainly not to shoot in the village. Enormous trouble taken to make sure that nobody could be identified with anybody who had actually lost their life in real time. And then to go back to the Queen in Aberfan, what's interesting is, of course, that she had such reluctance in going and was criticised for it. In the years since then, she's visited Aberfan 3, 4, 5 times, more than any other member of the royal family or more than any other politician who at the time expressed such great concern. I think it's a token of her sincerity.
How much of the crown is real? Because obviously there's, we don't know what she's really thinking or what's happening behind closed doors at Buckingham Palace. So how much is real, do you think? What's the percentage we're going for?
I would argue that in one sense, very little is real. And in another sense, it's all real. I mean, there's two sorts of reality. There is historical reality.
Yeah.
And then there is the reality that you create with informed and sensitive imagination. I like to compare historians to gardeners. This is not a comparison that's original to me. Other historians have said the same thing. But they point out there's a difference between the past and history. The past is what actually happened. The past is the millions and trillions of people who've lived on this earth and loved and fought and died. The past. Whereas then along comes the historian, like a gardener, holding out a sieve. And all the past runs through the sieve. And actually, the rich humus, the lovely fine earth you want, gets through the sieve. What is left in the sieve are a few pebbles and rocks and roots and things. And the historian looks at that proudly and says, oh, this is history. But of course, and that is what's verifiable, but what's happened to everything that's gone through the sieve? Mm. Well, that's what, as I say, Peter Morgan, the creator of the crown, is so good at diving into and imagining. So to go back to the stag in the Highlands, never happened, but it actually realistically portrays the situation.
So when you were asked to consult on it, you've got the books as well, and what's in the books, by the way? Where are we at with number two? Because the first book was for up to what year was it?
90? The thing about the crown is that obviously it's all set in Buckingham Palace with the royal family, but each season is based on a political figure,
right?
And so the first season was about Churchill and all that resonance between Churchill and the young queen. The second season was based on the rather feeble successors to Churchill, Eden, the Suez Crisis, Harold Macmillan, you've never had it so good, the 14th Alec Douglas Hume. And then the third season, which is on television at the moment, well, of course, Netflix is always on, but it's just been released, is about Harold Wilson and the Queen's first socialist prime minister. And you say you've seen the early episodes, so you'll have seen the anxiety that people felt about this left winger who'd actually specialized in relations with Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. As I point out in the book, when Harold Wilson came to power, there was actually a department of the CIA that believed he was a Russian spy. They also thought actually Willy Brandt in Germany was a Russian agent. And there were people in Britain's MI5, counter-espionage, who also feared that Harold Wilson, the prime minister, was a spy. And the Queen saw all these papers. So that's why the first episode is of The Crown dwells on that. And of course, ends with the wonderful discovery that the Russian spy isn't in Downing Street, but is in Buckingham Palace. Not to give the story away.
Yeah. Does the royal family prefer Tory governments?
To be quite honest, I think they do. Can you generalize about a family? I mean, I think I certainly see Prince Philip as a Tory. But, you know, as I think about Prince Charles,
Green, Lib Dem.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes, yes, with an election coming up. Let's imagine how they'd vote if they had a vote. Tim. The Queen doesn't have a vote.
No.
Does Prince Charles have a vote?
I don't know. Sure. Do they have a vote?
No, they don't. No. And then the ironic thing that I dwell on quite a lot in the book is the way in which by the 25-year stage of her reign, the Queen's favorite prime minister was Harold Wilson. This man she feared as a Russian spy, he comes in, by the end of his second term of office in the mid-70s, she's really sad to see him go. Oh, yeah. And there's a socialist inside our queen.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the first time I met you, you were on Sunday Brunch talking to you, and I said I was watching The Crown and I couldn't believe that the Prime Ministers used to go and see the Queen. And then I said, do they still do it? And you said, yes. And I know how naive I am. But I was like, what? They still go and see the Queen? Because I realised the Queen doesn't have power and she's not democratically voted in.
Yeah.
But you said, yeah, they still go and see the Queen. That, I found that really shocking.
Doesn't shock me. I mean, I think that illustrates, and it should be more widely known, you know, the essence of the British Constitution.
Yeah.
That once a week, these grand pompous men and women have to go along and bow the knee and bow the head to somebody. And we're talking about the weekly royal audience when the Prime Minister of the day goes along and goes through the papers. And certainly we have this episode, I don't know if it's on screen, but I've certainly got it in the book, that in a very early audience, Wilson was sitting there and the Queen said to him, very interesting, she said, ruffling through the papers, this plan for a new town out in Buckinghamshire. And he looked totally blank. She said, I think there's some idea of calling it, naming it after John Milton and Maynard Keynes, Milton Keynes. And he hadn't done his homework. And she had read the papers and he hadn't. And he always used to tell that story and say, you know, I always advise my successors, you better do your homework before you go and see the Queen, or you may find yourself caught short and rather lacking.
What is the papers? What does that mean?
These are the official that week's Acts of Parliament, that week's most important intelligence documents, the proceedings of cabinet. The Queen is one of the few people who looks at those. They go along in the boxes, as they're called, the red dispatch boxes. And the Queen solemnly reads through them and initials at the end to show that she has surveyed them.
It's a funny thing, wasn't it, when Boris Johnson was prolonging Parliament and everyone's banging on about democracy. Both sides were going, democracy here, democracy there, Brexit, democracy, everyone, democracy. And he has to go to the Queen, who's obviously not democratically voted in, to ask permission to prolong Parliament. And that was the bit which stood out for me as being so bizarre. But there's no way she could stop it, is there?
No, but there was, of course, a modern twist to that, because before he went to her, the case went to this new body, the Supreme Court. Mm. And without that, I mean, 10 years ago when it didn't exist, or 15 years ago, it would have been the Queen and her advisors entirely who decided, you can prorogue, but you can't dissolve, or there are these various things you can do with Parliament. I have heard the Queen, to start with, quite like the idea that the weight of the technicalities of that decision be taken away from her and be given to this Supreme Court. I think maybe they're having second thoughts about it now, because, you know, do we want a system where everything is decided by a Supreme Court? Some people would say yes, but I think the fact that the monarchy retains some powers is an important part of its ongoing authority.
I think I used the wrong word then when I was saying about proroguing Parliament. What did I say? I said something different, did I?
I don't think it matters. No, I mean, I think I'm not sure anybody knows. You used the right word when you said prorogue. At that time,
right,
we've had two things to do with Parliament. At that time, he wanted to prorogue it, give it a holiday.
Okay.
And then after that, he wanted to dissolve it to have a general election.
Well, I interviewed Harriet Harman on this podcast. I asked her, what do you think of the royal family? Because she believes in equality for all and everything. She goes, I won't get involved. And she goes, the one thing I will never talk about is the royal family. And I said, why is that? She goes, because you can't win, because the British public love them. And I just thought it was a fascinating thing that, as a politician, you know, there's obviously a lot of the people, I can't imagine, well, Jeremy Corbyn didn't even want to bow to the Queen, did he? So I imagine a lot on the left, especially, who literally don't have any interest in the royal family. And yet they know the public still hold the Queen up there so highly.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised she wasn't willing to express criticism, because my experience is that we have a very healthy debate in this country about the monarchy, which reflects our democracy. Though, of course, at the end of the day, there is now, over the years, a reverence that attaches to the Queen herself.
Yeah.
But I think people do criticise Prince Charles, and they're quite entitled to criticise Prince Charles.
Mm. What I was so shocked about this week is with the Andrew stuff happening, is how many people are willing to attack the royal family this week. Because I'm even watching Ant and Dec on, they're doing jokes about him on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Outfit. The Mail online have gone absolutely mad for it, haven't they? And they've started looking through the finances of the royal family, which is where the royal family can come unstuck. Because I imagine they generate huge amounts of money for the country and tourism and everything else. But it's quite an easy target to say we're paying money for this family, isn't it?
That is always the bottom line. You know, when, for example, Meghan and Harry would not disclose who the godparents were of little Archie, I suspect because maybe there's Serena Williams in there or George Clooney. You know, the argument then was, well, look, you've just had 2.5 million, is it? Yes, 2.5 million of taxpayers' money spent on your nice cottage in the Windsor Park. Your son is going to live on the payroll for the rest of his life, and he is sixth in line to the throne. I think we, the public, the taxpayers, are entitled to know who are the moral mentors of this child. Now, when it comes to it, I think somebody worked out that on the most recent figures, the royal family costs everybody in the country £1.24 per head. You know, what are we, 75, 80 million people in this country? And that's what the monarchy costs, a bit less, incidentally, than 1 year's budget of the crown. But most people would say that, you know, for £1.24 per head, they give good value. And there are countless surveys showing that the tourism income for this country is immensely boosted by the royal connections, the changing of the guard, going into the palaces and all that sort of thing. Obviously people would come to Britain anyway.
Yeah,
but the French identity...
French still get tourism, don't they?
Yeah.
Paris is still a good place, even though they beheaded their royal family, didn't they, a little while ago. So, yeah, but what does the rest of the world think of our royal family? My friend's been doing some work in China recently. Says they're absolutely fascinated by the Queen and the princes, but you know, not Charles, Edward and Andrew, but the William and Harry.
Well, there is the human interest of family, in which all the misadventures of Andrew will not in the long run make a difference. But that is linked to the history going back. You know, when we hear of a rift between the Duke of Sussex and the Duke of Cambridge, you wonder, well, is this a Shakespeare play?
Is this that William and Harry?
That is William and Harry. Sorry. I mean, I had to look to your kitchen ceiling to work out what their titles are. These are old medieval titles. And still to this day, we have two young princes who on fairly good authority, seem to be at odds with each other at the moment. And, you know, that's got a centuries-old appeal to it.
Why? Surely if you're part of the royal family, though, and Prince Harry needs to play the game, and as you quite rightly point out, he's not playing the game at the moment. That's the rules. That's the laws, isn't it? You've got to play the game. Mm-hmm. You've got to tell us who the godparents are. You've got to do it the right way. You've got to go and see the Queen at Christmas. Mm-hmm. It's just part of the game. Mm-hmm. But they're not playing it, are they?
No.
But they're not the first ones, because Margaret didn't play the game, did she, either?
No. And Princess Margaret, fascinating character. I mean, again, my book happens to have a lot about Princess Margaret in it, because Peter Morgan felt that he's actually got an episode that you've probably seen. I think the second episode is called Margaretology.
When she goes to America.
About the study of Princess Margaret. It's a slightly exaggerated reference to the fact that when Princess Margaret and Lord Snowden went to America in the early 60s, we desperately wanted a loan from America to bail us out. And part of the idea was that Margaret and Tony going there would help sway President Johnson, who'd just taken over from Kennedy. And that, in fact, was the case. Margaret, fascinating character, you know, the naughty little sister of the Queen. A little technical point I like to remind people of is that she was actually 4 or 5 years younger than the Queen. Right. And I think that made a big difference. If she'd just been 2 years younger than the Queen, I think they'd have established more of a partnership. I mean, I think if you were looking at one of the failures of the reign of the present Queen, it would be Princess Margaret. The fact that the two sisters didn't establish a partnership. No, look at the two young princes today and see their problems. But Margaret, being 4 years younger, was just always a bit out of it. So whereas during World War II, at 13 years old, the Queen was becoming a young adult and trained as her father's assistant, Margaret was the naughty little girl that everybody indulged. And that's somehow what she remained throughout her life.
So do you think at some stage they're going to, there's going to be a tap on the shoulder of Prince Harry, and they're going to say, come on, mate, you need to toe the line a bit here, because we've got to protect the family and you're going a bit left field?
I think that's already happened in terms of their advisors being sent the message. And I think we can see it in the strategy ahead that it seems as if Harry and Meghan are going to spend more time abroad. He's going to be given a Commonwealth brief, you know, looking to the days when it will just be the two brothers. That would seem to make sense. Of course, looking ahead, it's also going to be a very pared down royal family. I mean, when the Queen came to the throne, there were all these Kents and Gloucesters and uncles and cousins hanging around. I think it's going to be something of a challenge in the future. I mean, it makes it more modern, it makes it less expensive, it makes it more simple. But it does mean that relationship between those two brothers is going to be pretty crucial to the success of the whole enterprise.
So you're saying they sort of push him away for the time being, go out there, go and hang out in the Commonwealth for a while, leave William here and to get on.
Certainly the official line for the future. And apparently Harry and Meghan welcome that chance to get away. You know, Harry particularly feels that he's got great work to do in Africa. He has very happy memories of time he spent there. So that seems to be what they want to do in the future.
What's happening then? What is actually happening at the moment? Because what I loved about the Queen and the royal family was whatever scandal they threw at them, they went, we're not talking about it. That's it, we're ignoring it. They seem to be starting to talk to the press a bit more now. And I mean, Andrew doing his interview the other day on TV, but then you've got stuff which is quite shocking, like Prince Philip crashing the car and then getting in a car again. I mean, surely that's madness, especially with the way things are, you know, the amount of cameras out there now. You can't hide these things away. And you've got Harry and William at war with each other and, you know, all the other stuff, the ridiculously expensive baby shower, all these things that flying on the private jets all around whilst you're talking about the environment. It feels like years ago there would have been someone in the royal family going, you're not doing that. Sorry, we've got to... What's happening? Is it breaking down, do you think?
Yes, it is breaking down, but on the other hand, 'twas ever thus. You know, in the book I examine in some detail the relationship between the Queen in the 1960s and her racing manager, Lord Porchester.
Mm-hmm.
Porchy, he was called.
Yeah.
The Crown looks and presents Porchy as a significant character and friend of the Queen. And they go off to Kentucky together to look at bloodstock for a month, injecting some new bloodstock into the royal stables. And when they come back, Prince Philip suggests that maybe it's not just horse bloodstock that Porch is interested in injecting. Now, you know, is that tasteful? Is it not? The fact is that, you know, everybody always talks about Prince Philip being the saucy one. And, you know, that's referred to in season two of The Crown. But here we have the Queen's lifelong friend was Porchy, who as I point out in the book, he was married to an American lady who was also the Queen's best friend, Jean Wallop, she was called. One of the sadder incidents we'll be coming on to later is the fact that Porchy actually died on 9/11, watching 9/11 on television. Oh, yeah. And it so shocked him, he had a heart attack. Oh, by then, you know, he was in his 70s. So this is one of the odd things that the makers of The Crown and, you know, have discovered. They've become sort of semi-royal themselves, because you can't ignore the Queen's friendship with Porchy. So how do you deal with it? And you know that, you know, the moment you put it in, the Daily Mail, the Sun, the Daily Mirror will suddenly say, aha, naughty people on The Crown suggesting the Queen had a lover, which, you know, we go to some lengths to show that she didn't. But still, you know, she's entitled to her male friends, just like any other lady.
Well, are you worried about that then?
I, you know, after 40, 50 years of this, my skin has hardened. I mean, I would argue, and I certainly argue in the book, that, you know, it's proper to examine this. We set out all the facts. One of the lesser known interesting facts, do you know where Porchy lived all his life?
No.
I forget the actual name of the house where he lived. I should know, but it is he actually made quite a lot of nice dosh, and his family have made quite a lot of dosh renting it out for Downton Abbey. The set of the, you know, the castle that is Downton Abbey is Lord Carnarvon's home, where Porchy lived.
Do you think they've read the book or the books? Do you think, well, this one's not out yet. It's out now, just coming out now. But do you think they read them?
No, I think most of them, the sensible ones, make a rule not to read the books about them.
Do you think they've watched The Crown then, the series? Because isn't it the most expensive drama ever, TV series ever? £100 million been spent on it or something. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Do you think they've watched that? Meghan Markle's definitely watched it. But what about the other? So has. She's like, I'm one of them. What about the rest?
I wouldn't be surprised if they haven't. I mean, the official line is certainly nobody in the royal family has watched The Crown. I think that's one royal fib. And I'm, you know, they wouldn't be human if they hadn't.
Do they watch? Do they sit and watch telly? Don't they have their dinner on their laps? Someone once said, or something.
They have dinner on their laps. They have their breakfast porridge oats in Tupperware. On the table,
and Tupperware.
Yeah, the Queen has rather old, cherished Tupperware containers that she keeps her porridge oats in, and that's what she. And guests who go up to Balmoral have remarked on it that there are the oats for the porridge, for the cereal. Obviously, the porridge is the porridge, but the oats for the cereal for the muesli. Kept in Tupperware. Why not?
And The Crown, what always fascinates me is they're sort of having this conversation. By the way, the actors on The Crown, they're brilliant, aren't they? What do you think?
I'm just blown away. I mean, yeah. And I, you know, I love that opening sequence of the current season where you come in I was going to say Olivia Foy.
Claire Foy.
There is Claire Foy.
Yeah.
You imagine looking at the stamps and the camera swings round.
Yeah,
and you see brilliant. It's Olivia Colman. Yeah. And now you see that, as I say in the book, that actually happened. Well, it happened, you know, just in the mid-1960s, there was a fresh issue of stamps with that beautiful silhouette. It's actually called the Machin silhouette because it was a sculptor called Arnold Machin who made it. And one of the interesting things is that, and again, something I discuss in the book, you know, in the book, you can sort of go into the things that just you see fleetingly on television. The fact that we still have those stamps, don't we?
Yeah.
With the Queen, lovely silhouette of her in her 40s. But if you look at the coins in your pocket, you will see that the silhouette of the Queen is actually older. It's a lady in her late 50s or 60s. It's not the same as the one on the stamps. And that because in the 1990s, the Royal Mint and the Post Office went back to the Queen and said, I think the time has come, Your Majesty, to update your silhouette.
Right.
Which, as Olivia Colman says, just make me look more like an old bat. And apparently the Queen said something like that to them. And she eventually agreed that she'd let the coins be modernized, as it were, be made older. But she was not going to let the stamps.
The crown, the series is like Doctor Who. Every time you tune in, there's another queen. I mean, regenerate. I think for equality, the new one should be a man, obviously, like they've done with Doctor Who. No, it's fascinating. But when Olivia Colman's standing there and she's having a chat with Prince Philip, they've got people standing there with their toothbrushes and they're brushing their teeth, and they've got a servant stood there holding the toothbrush. Do you think that really happens?
Yes, it does happen.
Do they have people who dress them? Do they have people who dress them?
They have people who lay out their clothes, yes. And there's this lady called Angela Kelly, who is the Queen's dresser, who is, become one of her best friends, to the degree that the Queen has actually allowed her to produce her memoirs and really be quite revealing about what it's like. I mean, they live a different life. Whenever she travels, she has to have some black clothes in her suitcase in case there's a death somewhere and she has to appear in mourning. Wherever she travels, her entourage have to take some bottles of blood with them. And there's all, of her blood type and Prince Philip's blood type. And there's always a doctor who's got to be on duty. They take their own toilet paper with them in their own containers, which only they can open. There are all sorts of details, practical details in their life. So maybe it's not so surprising if Prince Andrew has a strange view on the world, because he's been looked after like that from an early age.
It was ill-advised for him to do that interview the other day, wasn't it?
It was very ill-advised, very arrogant, and as you've probably seen from what Emily Maitlis said, she was actually sitting down prepared to do a standard royal interview with a roundup of all his good causes and everything, and then get on to the real issue. And he was the one who said in his opening, well, it's never a good time to talk about Jeffrey Epstein, but let go. And, as we've heard, his professional PR had already resigned over that. He felt that he knew how to handle the situation. And so far, the fallout has proved that self-confidence was misplaced.
I know through reading through the press and everything, Prince Harry's always struggled with the idea that he's a royal, because he's not heir to the throne, as the Crown shows with Princess Margaret. Probably the same with Prince Andrew and Edward. It's tough being one of the people who are not heir to the throne, isn't it?
Yeah, and let's not forget, for many years, actually, Prince Harry was next in line to his elder brother.
Yeah.
And then, as William has had children, Harry has been pushed further down the line.
Yeah.
So that must create some ambivalence. And let's not forget, that's exactly the Prince Andrew situation. As Duke of York, he was next in line to Prince Charles for a number of years, and of course now been pushed, thankfully, a long way down the line of succession. The normal joy we all have at the birth of a little niece or nephew is rather, you may look at it slightly differently if it pushes you further into, he was a mainline royal. He's not anymore, but still trying to act like one.
What do they all do? I mean, we know what the Queen does. She's head of the state, and she really doesn't have to do much, does she? I know she does a lot. But when you start going down, what are they all doing?
Well, to be fair, the ones who are actually on the payroll, and we're talking about Prince Andrew, let's look at Prince Andrew, do have a lot of duties, which in the normal course of events, they just get on with. He's Chancellor of Hull University, goes and gives out the degrees whether the students of Hull will want to receive their degrees from his hands in the future, now becomes a question. He has, and let's be fair to him, he has made very good use of Buckingham Palace in order to use it as an environment where young entrepreneurs from disadvantaged backgrounds can be brought into contact with real hotshot businessmen who wouldn't give them the time of day, but are tempted by the chance to go into Buckingham Palace and therefore are prepared to meet these young people. They have a whole range of, the whole stream of good works in British public life is very much encouraged by the British royal family. So that's what they do, not all day long, but every week, each one who's on the payroll would have a number of events like that, going to visit old people's homes, all sorts of activities.
I got talking to someone who worked for Prince Andrew a while ago, but way before all this blew up, and I said to her, what do you think about it? And she goes, I'm split, because they spend a lot of money and he does go out and he does like going out for nice meals and hanging out with powerful people. But she said, when they turn up in a foreign country of some description and he goes to visit a company to try and get trade for Britain, they absolutely adore the fact a member of the royal family has turned up, because our royals are regarded so highly around the world. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's I couldn't have put it better myself. And that is why a misjudgment like the current one jeopardizes that situation, but I don't think in the long term.
Okay, so the book, I think never we got to the end of which how much this covers, this book. Mm-hmm. From where to where do we get to?
This book covers, it covers right up to the Silver Jubilee in 1977. And the Queen is a principal character. Princess Margaret, in those days, very glamorous with Lord Snowden, but we see the end of their marriage. As we were saying, Harold Wilson, it's a new era for the Queen, because for the first time she's dealing with a socialist government whom, for all the reasons we've been discussing, she manages to win over.
Big year, 77. Yeah, it's when the Sex Pistols came along and really started hammering the royal family, wasn't it? Punk and all that, anarchy. After that, we had Will the Crown carry on? Will your books carry on? Are you carrying on all the way up to the modern day?
Well, certainly the Crown will carry on. People now who are watching the third season,
yeah,
should reflect to themselves they are halfway through. It's not a secret. It is a secret what's going to be in future seasons.
Oh, yeah.
But it is not a secret. But we can guess about some of the content,
yeah,
obviously. But there will be three more seasons, and one of them is currently being filmed at the moment. Season 4, which is centered around Mrs. Thatcher.
Yeah,
and her relationship with the Queen, with Mrs. Thatcher being played by Gillian Anderson.
Oh.
That much is not a secret. It's being filmed at the moment, and this time next year it'll be on our screens. And there'll be a year's break, and in that season we'll also see the new Diana appear. And then there'll be two more seasons, and exactly where they take us, that's a secret, but it also hasn't finally been decided.
We're going to have It's a Knockout with Andrew and Edward. Do you remember when they did that? That was bizarre.
Yeah.
That was when they were modernising the royal family, wasn't it? Backfire. I can imagine after that, the Queen calling them to one side, never do that again. That's ridiculous. We got the bloke who broke into the Buckingham Palace. What was his name? Peter something, wasn't it? I can't remember.
Yep.
What was his name? You can't remember. No one can remember. He broke into... So we've got all that to come, haven't we? All those sort of things.
All those excitements. And we got Tony Blair.
Yes.
And we've got Charles eventually marrying Camilla, having been through, and of course there's going to be the death of Diana reprised again for Peter.
That's going to be huge. That episode. Michael Fagan, that was that was weird how he managed to get in, wasn't it? Those years ago. All right.
Well, I mean, I think he was sort of smuggled in a Tupperware container, probably.
So, just final question before I get into my questions that I ask everybody. Mm-hmm. Final question: do you see the future rosy for the royal family? What's your view on it?
I think the short-term future, not because of the Andrew issue, and I think there are conflicts there in the relationship between the two brothers that are going to have to be played out. I think the long and of course the magic that we've got used to will eventually vanish with Prince Philip and the Queen, sadly. Mortality has its way. But, mortality will result, I think, in a rebirth and a new identity.
We haven't touched on Prince Philip. He's a huge character in all these series. Do you like him? Are you a fan?
Prince Philip, I do like, because when I first started writing about the royal family, he was the one person who was prepared to sit down and talk to me. I interviewed I started with Lord Mountbatten, who was a sort of self-proclaimed publicist for the royal family, and without giving too much away, he becomes a very major character in this season we're watching at the moment, and of course in the season to come, the death of Mountbatten. His murder will be a major episode. He led me on to Prince Philip, and so I've always had a lot of time for Prince Philip. Not that he knows me any more than the Queen knows me.
Yeah. Why did he want to talk to you?
Well, Mountbatten was, as I say, a sort of self-appointed publicist for the royal family. I remember one of the great things he told me, one of my earliest scoops, was the inside story of the Suez Crisis and the way in which Britain and France had secretly connived with Israel to stage the invasion of the Suez Canal Zone by Israel to give us an excuse to go and invade Egypt. I was able to put that into my first book, Majesty. And Prince Philip was very keen to talk about Outward Bound and, his own views of the monarchy, which, very much come to pass.
People must love having you around for dinner, because they can sit at your dinner party. They can just ask you every question about the royal family. Mark wants to ask a question.
Can you repeat?
Yes, okay.
What do you think about how true do you think the plot to remove Harold Wilson?
The Mountbatten plot is the subject of a whole chapter in my book. I'm glad you asked about that, Mark. It's called Coup, and I actually have sat in the room where the plot was hatched. It's in Kinnerton Street, round the back of Buckingham Palace, a little muse house. When I went to interview Lord Mountbatten, I didn't know at the time, that was the very room where he sat with the plotters, notably Cecil King. Luckily, Mountbatten invited along his friend Solly Zuckerman, who is shown in the episode, and it was just when Zuckerman could see that Mountbatten was getting rather intrigued by this idea that he might head up a government of national unity. Zuckerman said, "What you're talking," he said this to Cecil King and Hugh Cudlip, the Mirror, "what you're talking is absolute treason. I'll have nothing to do with it, and nor should you, Dickie?" And Dickie Mountbatten said, no, I suppose not. No. And so by Zuckerman's account, he saved the day. But it certainly happened. Yes.
Have you never had a call off the people behind the scenes people and said, "Look, we need to have a chat with you. You know, be careful because you're pushing it too far." Have they never done that with you, the royal family?
Never. No. I've had quite a lot to do with their PR people, and I must say, when it comes to dealing with PR people, they're very straight. They say what they want, but it's up to you to take it or leave it. No arm twisting.
All these conspiracy theories, just nonsense, especially the Diana ones.
Well, we'll be examining that in the next season, or the season after, rather. My instinct is always to rebel against conspiracy theorists, but who knows? When it comes to Diana, there were some pretty murky waters there.
Okay. Intriguing. We'll have to wait and see. We'll have to read the book. All right. Do you mind if I ask you the questions that I ask everybody?
Please do.
I'm conscious I've taken up quite a lot of your time. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Well, Tim, I decided the listeners really aren't interested in me. I have done some research to discover what answers the Queen would give you this situation.
Okay, good.
So what one piece of advice would you like to give to listeners that's been invaluable to her life, in your life? Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be better to you than light and safer than a known way. That is known to be a quotation the Queen will often make. Her father made it in one of his Christmas broadcasts during the war. It was actually discovered for him by the Queen. And the point I like to make here is that the Queen is a believing Christian. We got this into the Crown, actually, thanks to me. In an earlier episode, you may remember, she invites the American evangelist, Dr. Yep. Billy Graham.
Yeah.
That is quite true, that he came to London, he carried out his evangelical crusade, and the Queen listened to it on the radio and loved it, invited him to Buckingham Palace, and whenever he came to London after that, he was invited to preach, and when she went to America, she went to visit him, because she is, this may sound out patronizing thing to say, an old-fashioned Christian. If you listen to her Christmas broadcast, she gives out the touchy-feely stuff, and then she says, "We are here to remember the birth of Jesus, the Son of God." She literally believes the Christian gospel, and it's been a very important part of her life.
But I read something, because she's the head of the church over here, isn't she? I read something, either in one of your books or online, or you might have told me this or something, that she's closer to God than the rest of us in her position, and she believes that?
No, I don't think she believes that. No, she has a humility.
Right.
But obviously she has official religious roles that raise her above us. I mean, she is head of the Church of England, but it's a position she, you know, takes very, very, very seriously.
So then Prince Harry not going to spend Christmas with her is going to be terrible for them.
Yes, although here again, I think we step sideways from, you know, religion and look at, you know, the family situation. On the other hand, I imagine what Prince Harry has said to his grandmother is, look, you know, ordinary families go from one set of relatives to the other at Christmas.
Yeah.
let's see where he goes next year.
Yeah, but ordinary families are not paid by the taxpayer, you know. So, right, what's something you think people should know?
She once said to a friend, "I've looked in two directions for my entire life, upwards towards God and outwards towards my people." And I think that sums up, you know, the duty that she feels.
Okay. Any life hacks the Queen might have? Interesting.
Always travel with a black dress, few pints
good.
Of blood.
That's good.
Also, she's a, when it comes to travel tips, she's a great believer. She's a homeopath. So she's a great believer in barley sugar. She travels with barley sugar for her jet lag. She also travels with scones and clotted cream and Dundee cake, because wherever she goes in the world, she believes in having a sitting down for a nice English high tea.
That's fantastic. How old is she now?
Born in 1926. So she's 93.
She's
the Queen's biographer, not knowing what decade she lives in.
Yeah. 93. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Has she changed her mind about anything?
Yes, I think we've seen, I mean, I talked earlier about the walkabouts. She's changed her mind enormously about what her job is. Once it was to be remote, now it is to reach out and, you know, get involved with people. And, you know, in this very season of ABBA fan, we see when that came to pass, when she realized that the old ways would have to go and she would have to reach out and take a risk with people.
Can she recommend a book?
Yes, she would. She would
it's
recommend.
Like, it's like I've had the Queen on the podcast, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. She would recommend the Gospel of St. John. Because she once said when she met Billy Graham He said that he told her the story, what he reminded her of the story from the Gospel of St. John about the invalid that Jesus lifted up.
Yeah.
And she actually said, and he said, I was thinking of using that as the theme for my sermon. And she said, I wish you had. That is my favorite story.
So, anyway. I love the impact the royal family has on us and our culture. I don't know whether I'm pro them or anti them. I swing wildly between the two thought processes. But when I watched the Harry and Meghan Markle wedding, I had my little daughter. She was, I think, 4 or 5 at the time. And I said, look, they're getting married. And she was like, oh, that's wonderful. And I said, there's the Queen. She goes, the Queen's there. It's such a huge thing for a child. And she was like, why isn't she wearing a crown? I do think she should wear a crown more often. You know, I think that's an important thing for royal family too.
Yeah. From the publicity photographs, Helena Bonham Carter has insisted on wearing a crown in the bath as Princess Margaret.
A
coronet, perhaps.
I think that's great. I mean, the one thing she did, which is great, she came home the other day, and I think this is such an amazing thing. She goes, Daddy, I've learned to wave like the Queen, and starts doing that wave. And she keeps doing it all the time to me. She looks over and she does that. Well, you can't see it, we're audio, but keeps waving to me like the Queen. I think it's so funny that one of the Queen's catchphrases is her wave, you know. Yeah. She does wave. Right, final question then. What's the meaning of life? Do you know what the Queen's meaning of life is?
The Queen's meaning of life is service, duty. I mean, that's what her whole life has been built around. As I said, she came of age during the war when service and duty were not things to be laughed at in any way, and that's what she's kept going to the present day. And I think that's the essence of why people love the crown, a woman who is dedicated to her duty to other people.
Yeah, whatever you think about the Queen, she's been a great servant to the country, hasn't she, through the war? And I mean, she kind of had an easy life. Let's face it, we're all going, oh, she's got all this money, but she's stuck in the palace, and then she has to meet all these hundreds and thousands of people over the years, shaking their hands, and and it must be quite tiring for her, the whole
thing. Yeah, and I think what you put your finger on there is the fact that, you could say that as an apology for all of them. Poor Prince Charles, poor Prince Andrew, and as you move down the list, you wonder whether you really mean it. But when it comes to the Queen, you know that her service and duty has been absolutely genuine. Mm. And that is what we've responded to all these years.
Mm. Robert, thank you so much. It's been such a great conversation with you about the royal family. Your book, The Crown, Political Scandal, Personal Struggle, and the Years That Defined Elizabeth II, is out now. The Inside Story, 56 to 77. The first book's already out, isn't it? And this one's just coming out now. Thank you so much. Hopefully we can talk as the next series of The Crown and your next book comes out.
Look forward to that, Tim. Thank you very much indeed. And the only thing we have to arrange now is for the Queen to come to the kitchen.
If you can sort that, or Prince Philip, I'll accept him. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.
That was Robert Lacey. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with him. I'm sad to say, though, I've let you down. As listeners, I've let you down.
I mean, it's a weekly thing now, Tim.
But I've let you down. I properly let you down because there's one question I forgot to ask him. And as he was leaving, I went, oh, Robert, oh, no, I forgot to ask you this question. And I asked it, and it was a great answer. And I'm not going to tell you. No, I am going to tell you. The question was, does the Queen get annoyed with the honours list?
Because, well, the honours list that other people...
Well, the honours list that the Prime Ministers...
Yeah.
Are the ones who, as they're leaving, they have their honours list. And a lot of people have been talking about that. And also just the honours list in general, I imagine. We didn't get stuck into that, but he said, oh, yeah.
It was a definite answer, wasn't it?
Yeah, he immediately went, she gets really frustrated with it, especially when it comes to... Then he quoted a time where it was Harold Wilson. He had a thing called a lavender list. And apparently he went really over the top with the amount of honours he gave out as he left office. But obviously, it's got her name on them, the honours list, and so I let you down because we could have expanded that.
That's
conversation.
What it's like.
But I hope the rest of it you enjoyed. But that bit, I'm sorry. So where are you with the royal family, Mark? I'm going to put you right on the spot here. Are you like me, who swings, or are you pro? Think, are you anti? That, where are you at?
I think when I was younger, as a younger man, I think I was really dead against them.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and I think I've softened a lot in recent years because of stuff like The Crown, where you realise they are people put in a really, really ridiculous... It's not like Taylor Swift who wanted to be famous.
Yeah.
You're born into that. And it is a strange existence, I think.
You can leave, though.
You can leave, but you become a national and social pariah, don't you? You know, you look what happened to...
I suppose so. I didn't think about it like
it's
that.
You're in it for life. It's, you know,
no, I think we'd
like
accept
the
it
mob.
Now. If Harry or William or one of the younger ones said, look, do you mind, I'm going to leave the royal family because I just, it's not for me. I think the all of us would go... Well,
I could see that happening.
Yeah, but we can get that. And they say, look, I'm not going to take any more taxpayers' money. I'm just going to go off and do my own thing. Is that okay? I think if Harry did it, I think William might struggle because he's heir to the throne. But I think if Harry did it, I don't think anyone would care. They'd all go, mate, good luck. And he'd make an absolute fortune because people would love him. You know, he's the guy who left the royal family. But I don't know. It's a weird one.
I swing back and forward. Depending on the story.
Well, when they get married, I like watching it. Yeah, I like. Yeah. We're good at it in this country. We're good at pomp and ceremony, aren't we? We're
very, very good.
We're good at that.
Yeah, and actually, I hadn't thought about yourself and Robert were talking about the Trump coming over, or you know, someone coming over, and it is amazing.
I just think that the way I look at it now with the royal family is you've got the Queen, and then you've got the royal family, and when the Queen passes, when the Queen dies, basically, we're going to have to then analyze what the royal family is, and then Charles is on the throne, or William gets on the throne, whoever gets on the throne, then we have to relook at it and see what happens there. But you know, it's fascinating how they've survived all these years, and you know, and what they have to do to survive. It's really, really interesting.
I love that interview though.
Oh, good. Robert a lovely bloke?
We've got to have him back.
He's such a lovely bloke.
What a great advert for his book, which I cannot wait to read. He's actually kindly given me a
you're
copy.
You're really excited about it, aren't you?
I'm quite excited about that. But also, what a great advert for the few years coming up of...
Yeah, when he's saying about what we're going to watch.
It's going to be... you should watch The Queen. If you like The Crown, you will love The Queen. And really? I'm really interested to see how they... Because they're going to be going into that territory, as he said, with Tony Blair and Princess Diana. That's what that was about. It's going to be really interesting how he's going to have to find a different... Because he can't just rehash that. It'd be amazing.
I'm fascinated. Have you read Tony Blair's book?
No.
It was a long time ago that I read it, but Tony Blair sort of basically says he saved the royal family. Is that what the film portrays him as?
No.
A little bit?
No, it's them saving themselves, actually, with his help, maybe.
Right. In his book, he seems to imply... It's been a long time since I read it, but I seem to remember his book was like, please love me, because it was obviously after the time he'd gone and everyone had sort of, you know, weapons of mass destruction and all that sort of stuff. It was like, please love me, I saved the royal family and I modernised them, saved them, and I also sorted out the problem in Ireland and everything else. It was kind of one of those sort of books as I remember it. But then who knows? My memory is absolutely appalling. This podcast is sponsored by Quooker. It's spelt Quooker with a Q.
Like the Queen.
U. Yeah, like the Queen.
It's the Queen of Taps.
Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. I'm going to wave to you like the Queen, Mark.
Thank you very much. That works well on the podcast.
I'm doing it as we speak. I've put my head to a slight side as I'm doing it. There you go. Quooker. It's 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It does hot water, your normal hot water, your normal cold water. It's 100 degree boiling hot water. It does your chilled filtered water, and it does your chilled filtered sparkling water. Woo-hoo! Which Mark is drinking at the moment because he loves a bit of that. Thanks to them for sponsoring the podcast, because it does really help. And,
I tell you what,
and it's a great product. I love it.
Yeah, I tell you what, actually, as well, we were looking up. Do you remember last time we spoke, you know, Google moment, Tim? We were talking about the benefits of drinking hot water.
Oh yeah,
Boiling hot water.
Do you remember them, or should I look them up?
Have a quick look.
Google benefits of drinking hot water.
It's quite remarkable. There's a list about as long as your arm.
Do you reckon the Queen has
a cooker tap?
Yeah,
she. Do you know, I think it's very old school back in the palace.
Do you reckon she has a computer?
I'm sure there is one there. But that's the thing. If you get a cooker tap, you're better than the Queen.
Oh, yeah.
Had you thought of that?
I'm now going to wave like the Queen again at you.
It's working really well, Tim.
It was so funny that every time I looked at my daughter, she's six now, and every time I look at her, she just kept waving like she was the Queen. So funny, because I remember doing it at school, where everyone learns how to wave like the Queen. It's like your Alan Shearer goal celebration.
Yeah, yeah.
How many people are famous for an arm action?
Well, let's not go there.
Oh yeah, Mr. Hitler.
Not that one.
Ricky Gervais when he does his funny dance thing.
Yeah.
I can't think of any others. There must be other ones.
Please write in with famous arms.
I know there's that thing, the tab or the dab. No, the dab. The dab.
Yeah, the dab. Yeah.
Oh, and all right, let's move on. Right, there are 10 ways that drinking hot water may benefit you. Relieves nasal congestion. The warmth of hot water creates steam, apparently. Aids digestion.
There you go.
Calms central nervous system. Helps relieve constipation. That's for you, Mark. How childish was that?
I might start going up to use the upstairs toilet.
Keeps you hydrated. May aid in weight loss. Nah. Anything which says weight loss, I'm like, nah. Improved circulation. Can decrease stress.
Hot water with lemon does help with levels. Hot water with lemon does. They stuck it's a proper thing with weight loss.
Nah.
All right.
Nah. I'm not doing it. So it's good for you. Hot water. Just getting water on board is good for you, yeah. I imagine. But thanks for Cooker for sponsoring the podcast. I think that's it from us this week, isn't it? So I thoroughly enjoyed that. We'll be back very soon. We've got a few podcasts coming out, which we love. There's some really good ones we've got coming to you soon. So we'll speak to you all very soon. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.
Bye! Thank you for listening to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Mark Augustin. If you would like to contact us, then our email address is dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Or Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.